Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, let's do it again. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. At the same time, we tell you about interesting and important things that are happening around the world. Today, we begin with news from the United Nations about peacekeeping in Africa. New studies have just been released. Then, a bit later, some entertainment. We'll travel to the city of Houston, Texas, for a festival that reminds us of the American West and when being a cowboy was a common occupation. Let's get started with part one. Peacekeeping operations are often criticized. In September 2014, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon asked a group to study all of the UN peacekeeping and political missions. Yair Vandelein is head of peace operations research at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. His organization held meetings in Addis Ababa to discuss African peacekeeping problems and ways to solve them. He wrote a report based on the talks to give to the panel. Kelly Jean Kelly has more.
There are new problems for peacekeeping. One is that criminals and jihadists can easily cross some borders. These are borders that do not have strong security in place. Another problem has to do with equipment. Mr. Vanderlein says, bombs killed many peacekeepers in Mali. The bombs are left in the road or carried by people. To be safe, the peacekeepers need vehicles with strong sides that resist bombs.
If you start to look at all the incidents, then you find that most of those casualties, fatalities, are the result of IEDs that killed people because the vehicles that they were traveling in were not IED-proof. So just making sure that particularly Chadian soldiers travel in Mali with the required armed personnel carriers would already save a lot of lives.
The study found that people in countries where peacekeeping forces are working want them to use force to protect civilians. But the commanders may not always order their troops to use force. They do not want to put their troops in danger. The report says, although the troops have orders, or a mandate, to protect civilians, the politicians in the home country of the UN troops can also give orders to the commanders.
That's why you see in some operations that the operations remain passive, not necessarily because the mandate is passive. No, quite often the mandate of an operation is very robust and says you should intervene and you should protect civilians. Not necessarily because the force commander of the peace operation doesn't want to do it, but quite often because the troop contributor in the end decides that they think it is too dangerous to actually protect the civilians. In practice, they basically have a second line of command, and that's their own capitals. And that is a problem that the UN, they are aware of, and they're trying to find solutions.
Mr. Vanderlein says the UN must be clear about the orders they give to peacekeeping troops. The troops might not have a mandate or order to protect all civilians, or they may not have everything they need to protect all of the civilians in an area. When people expect protection and the troops cannot provide it, the people get angry. This has happened in Mali, South Sudan, and the Eastern Congo. Some who talked with the researchers said the weak borders mean that UN operations should take place in several countries at one time. This creates a question of sovereignty, or the right of a country to control what happens in its borders. Mr. van der Leen thinks most countries will not agree to peacekeeping operations that cross national borders because they do not want to give up their sovereignty. But, he says, the UN should make plans for peace operations based on cooperation between the United Nations and the African Union and sub-regional organizations. The study found that there are also worries about the cost of peacekeeping. The countries that pay for it are mostly Western, industrialized countries. The countries that provide the troops are middle and low-income states. They often complain about each other. Mr. van der Leen says, over the last year, payments to low-income countries providing soldiers has increased. This has helped the relationship, but it would also be good if those giving troops contributed money, and those giving money also sent troops. This exchange might help them understand each other better. There are 16 peace operations with 120,000 UN personnel around the world. 9 of them, with about 81,000 personnel members, are in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo is the largest event of its kind in the world. The yearly event features horse and bull riders from all over the huge state of Texas. The trail rides are part of a tradition that remains strong while the city of Houston keeps expanding. Every year, the Houston rodeo season begins with a parade downtown. The riders travel highways and city streets to get there. Tim Bernadol, one of the riders, came in with a group from a rural area north of the city.
It's getting harder every year for us just to find stops, to be able to stop safely and be safely on the side of the roads, to have our brakes stop.
The riders don't sleep on the cold, hard ground the way old-time cowboys did. James Money is a rancher from Booth, Texas, about 45 kilometers away. He slept in a comfortable camp trailer every night of the ride to Houston.
I don't know if we're as hard as the old-timers. You know, we have to have luxuries to be able to do it.
The day before the parade, riders make their last camp in Houston's Memorial Park. Here they can relax and practice their cowboy skills.
Congratulations on an outstanding trail ride.
There is also an award ceremony. Carula Palwitz is a visitor from Germany. She gets to see some of the riders during the ceremony.
It's very nice to see a little bit of the culture here and get a little bit of the mood here of Texas.
The big winner at the award ceremony was the Texas Independence Trail Ride from Brazoria, Texas. Joey Bolaños is among the proud winners.
It's like the best of the best. Organization, the horsemanship, and safety and all that.
Ed Coas, another of the ranchers, says tradition is the most important part of the trail ride.
It's part of my heritage. My daddy was a rancher and farmer. His daddy was a rancher and farmer. We all were at one time in this Houston area. So we got to keep this going.
Most trail riders are not ranchers. However, they have to take care of their animals throughout the year. 10-year-old Kaven says he does that work at home, although his little sisters disagree.
He don't ride his horses at home. He don't do hardly nothing at home with his horses.
I do.
The Barn Bunch riders even bring along their own specially designed fire barrel for the cold nights. Daphne Johnson is the team leader. She says the week-long ride can be tiring.
By Wednesday, everybody's saying, oh my gosh, I can't wait until this is over. By the time we get to the park, we're saying, oh, no, the trail is almost over. And then on Sunday, we're planning for next year.
Daphne Johnson says she enjoys spending time every year with others who enjoy a taste of cowboy life. Time for us to ride off into the sunset. Thanks for listening. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, and this is VOA.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Charles LeBeau is a public speaking professor and consultant. Currently, he teaches at two universities in Japan and at the Toshiba International Training Center. English is the language of many international conferences. Sometimes a speaker might use a kind of world English that audience members do not understand. This can be true even for listeners who are native speakers of English. For this reason, Professor Charles LeBeau says the visual message is important. It can help carry the message when the presenter's words are hard to understand.
The visual message becomes a very central part of the communication process because everyone can understand a graph. Everyone can understand a flow chart. Everyone can see the words on the slide.
When you prepare a presentation, you might want to show how much you know about a subject. Listeners more likely want to understand the main point of your presentation. How do you organize your talk to get that point across?
They're not thinking clearly about what is the key point in my presentation.
For presentations in English, the best time to make that point is at the beginning. Speakers should make a plan to present their ideas in the order that is common in English rhetoric. Professor LeBeau says he often sees the engineers he works with give a lot of technical information in their speeches. They want to tell everything they know, but the audience may have trouble understanding which information is related to the speaker's main point.
In an English language presentation, what we try and do is make it more linear. And by that, I mean it's more of a story. We use data and we use evidence, we use numbers, but only to help us tell the story more clearly.
Professor LeBeau gives these five tips for academic presentations, such as those given at professional conferences. 1. Understand the difference between a title and a topic. A topic is general, but a title is more specific. Make sure the title explains the benefit of your subject. 2. Provide an image for those who are not experts in your subject. Explain how your research relates to other fields. 3. Work on transitions, linking words or phrases as you go from image to image. These should make the connections between your ideas clear. 4. Look at each image from the audience's point of view. What questions might they have about each image? Prepare an extra image that would help explain the most difficult question you expect. 5. Rehearse your presentation with a timing device. At most conferences, there is a time limit. It is disrespectful to take more than your share of the time. Cut your presentation to fit the time you are permitted. Using these tips for improving your presentations in English should help make the process easier. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1890s, the American people were deeply divided over the nation's money system. Should the United States support its currency with gold or with gold and silver? The question became the main issue in the presidential election of 1896. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell the story of that election.
Many Americans wanted a gold standard. They said the United States should support its money only with gold. A gold standard, they said, would keep the value of the dollar high. These people were called gold bugs. Most were businessmen, bankers, and investors. Many other Americans wanted the United States to support its money with both gold and silver. They thought the value of the dollar was too high. A high dollar, they said, drove down prices for agricultural products. A silver standard would lower the value of the dollar. These people were called silverites. Most were farmers, laborers, and owners of small businesses.
The debate over gold and silver was especially important because of an economic depression that began in the United States in 1893. Thousands of banks and businesses closed. Millions of men lost their jobs. Foreign investors withdrew their money from America. Americans who had money were afraid to invest it. Many people believed the Depression would end if the government issued more paper money backed by silver. President Grover Cleveland disagreed, and he opposed any legislation that might threaten the gold standard. He noted that every major nation supported its paper money with gold. The United States would be foolish, he said, not to do the same. It could not stand apart from the world's other money systems.
President Cleveland belonged to the Democratic Party. By 1896, many Democrats had become silverites. They gained control of party organizations in several western and southern states. They called Cleveland a traitor to his party and to the American people. They did not want him to be the party's candidate in that year's election. The Republican Party also was divided over the issue of gold and silver. Some members from silver mining states in the West left the party. Others remained in the party but gave support secretly to silverite Democrats. Republicans had done well in the congressional elections of 1894. They won control of both the Senate and House of Representatives. Party leaders were sure a Republican could be elected president in 1896. The most likely candidate appeared to be Governor William McKinley of Ohio.
McKinley was, in fact, nominated on the first ballot at the Republican convention in St. Louis, Missouri. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. The most likely candidate was Congressman Richard Bland of Missouri. A majority of convention delegates, however, were silverites, and they expected to nominate a silverite candidate. Supporters of President Cleveland wanted to test the silverites' strength. they demanded a debate on the gold-silver issue. Several men spoke in support of President Cleveland and the gold standard. Several spoke in support of silver. The last to speak was Congressman William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska. He had led an unsuccessful fight in Congress to keep America using silver.
Bryan spoke emotionally during the convention debate. He said he represented America's farmers, laborers, and small businessmen who wanted a silver standard. Bryan ended his speech with a line that became famous during the campaign. It called to mind the torture and death of Jesus Christ. Bryan said gold supporters could not force their money system on silver supporters. "You shall not," he said, "crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." With those words, William Jennings Bryan won the nomination away from Congressman Bland. He would be the Democrats' presidential candidate. He was just 36 years old.
A number of Democrats refused to accept Bryan as their candidate. They withdrew from the Chicago convention and held one of their own. They called themselves National Democrats. They nominated candidates for president and vice president, but they did not win many votes in the election. America's third party at that time, the People's Party, had a difficult decision to make. Populists, as they were called, agreed with silverite Democrats that the United States should have a silver standard. So some believed the party should unite with the Democrats to support Democratic candidate William Jennings Bryan. If they did not, Republican William McKinley was sure to win the election. Other populists feared that such a union would mean the end of the People's Party. The populists solved the problem at their nominating convention. Like the Democrats, they chose Bryan to be their candidate for president. But they chose a different candidate for vice president. In this way, William Jennings Bryan was able to run for president at the head of two separate political parties.
There was a great difference in the way the two presidential candidates campaigned. William McKinley refused to travel. Instead of going to the voters, he let the voters come to him, and they did. Railroad companies supported McKinley. They ran special trains to his home in Ohio. The trip was free. Each trip was the same. A band met the train and marched with the group to McKinley's home. McKinley came outside to hear a statement of support from the leader of the group. Then he made a short speech and shook hands. The group left, and another one came. On one day of the campaign, McKinley met 30 groups this way. That was more than 80,000 people.
While McKinley stayed at home, William Jennings Bryan traveled. He visited 27 states and spoke to 5 million people. Bryan explained that he had to travel because the Democratic Party did not have enough money to campaign in other ways. Bryan spent $650,000 on his campaign, McKinley spent $3.5 million. Bryan's main campaign idea was that the gold standard would ruin America's economy. McKinley's main campaign idea was that silver money would ruin the economy. For a time, Bryan's campaign seemed to be succeeding. More and more people promised to support him. Then, in the final weeks before Election Day, the situation began to change. The depressed economy showed signs of improving. The price of wheat rose for the first time in several years. Perhaps, people said, it was wrong to blame gold for the Depression. Perhaps, they said, the ideas of William Jennings Bryan were wrong.
On Election Day, it was soon clear who had won. McKinley received 270 electoral votes. Bryan received 176. Bryan congratulated McKinley. Then he told his supporters to begin getting ready for the next presidential election. "If we are right about silver," Bryan said, "we will win 4 years from now."
McKinley's election seemed to give new life to the American economy. Within a month, a business publication reported that buying and selling had increased greatly. It said demand for goods had led to the reopening of factories closed during the Depression. At the same time, new supplies of gold were discovered in Alaska, Australia, and South Africa. The extra gold increased the supply of money in the same way silver would have increased it. Taxes on imported goods rose to almost 60%. Under this protective tariff, American industry grew fast. The Depression ended.
The economic depression of the 1890s forced Americans to worry first about developments at home. But there were a number of international developments then which involved the United States. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.